senior IRGC commander has warned that if Israel takes any action against Iranian nuclear sites, the regime will face a more powerful response in kind. Hamas hails Iran's punitive operation against Israel as a legitimate and deserved response to the regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Also in the headlines, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that a man-made famine is tightening its grip on Gaza as Israel continues to block aid into the besieged strip. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran warns that it might reconsider its nuclear doctrine and policies in case of any Israeli aggression against its nuclear facilities.
If the fake Zionist regime threatens or takes any actions against our country's nuclear facilities as a means to put pressure on Iran, it would be possible and foreseeable for Iran to revise its nuclear doctrine and policies and leave behind the previously declared considerations.
Ahmad Haqtalab, the commander of the IRGC unit, responsible for safeguarding Iran's nuclear sites, said that Iran is ready to respond in kind if the Zionist regime takes any hostile action against its nuclear sites. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps general added that Iran has identified Israel's nuclear sites and powerful Iranian missiles are ready to destroy the specified targets at any moment. He emphasized that Iran's response to a possible new attack will be much stronger than the one before. Elijah Magner is a journalist and political analyst who joins us to share with us his thoughts on this. Welcome. So, you know, you have this Operation True Promise that gave Israel a taste of what Iran has in its military arsenal and how effective it can be. And you would think that that would teach Israel a lesson, as Iran has stated. But Israel is continuing with its threats and has taken it to another level, threat-wise, by saying it's going to target Iran's nuclear facilities, of which Iran has responded, of which I need to ask your reaction to the response that Iran has given. What do you make of it?
I think this is an excellent announcement from Iran to reconsider the fatwa of the Wali Faqih Sayyid Ali Khamenei that forbid the nuclear weapons, because Israel and all its partners understand only the language of force. The reason why Israel did not attack Iran so far, it is because Iran has imposed a strategic punishment on the Israelis and proved that it can retaliate. It has the power and the capability, and it is extremely well equipped with enough missiles to impose deterrence on Israel. Now, if Israel is not going to refrain from continuing its attack or from carry out sabotage attacks or assassination, which is the Israeli speciality along with the CIA, then I think by talking about the possibility of having nuclear weapons, it is enough to deter not only the Israelis, but the entire West club, because thinking that Iran one day, which is extremely easy for Iran to do it, as Iran has reached the 60% and it has centrifuges that are very advanced, that move from IR-1 to IR-6 and IR-8, that it has the capability in a very short time to produce nuclear weapons, not to use them, but to use the technology as a deterrence against Israel and America if one day the Americans and the Israelis would think of attacking Iran. And I think that per se, it is a huge game changer for Iran, and it is a biggest position to put back the Israelis and the Americans in their right place.
All right, forgive me if I ask this question, not to doubt what you have said, but I need to make sure that we, at least through your eyes, understand this correctly. Is it proper to ask here, because we at this point don't have any indications of nuclear weapons coming from the Iranian government, but does a change in Iran's nuclear doctrine mean that Iran would go after nuclear weapons? This change in nuclear doctrine, could it mean other things?
A long time ago, General Charles de Gaulle, who was the head of the resistance in France and later on became a president, said you have to show the strength and you don't need to use it. By Iran IRGC general to come out, it is not an individual position. It is a position at a very high level, and it is something that the IRGC, faithful to the command of its leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, would not come out and challenge the fatwa. Therefore, it is a warning to the West, don't push us, otherwise we will go where you have been always afraid of us going, because this is where you are pushing us. And for the Americans to come out and say that we are going to support Israel and we are not going to leave Israel alone is giving a free hand to the Israelis to go and commit further violation of human rights, violation of the Geneva Convention, the Vienna Convention, and challenging a country like Iran by destroying its consulate that is considered Iranian territory. Iran did not start by attacking Israel. Israel has started. And to the level of hypocrisy the West has reached by talking only about the Iranian retaliation and not talking about the Israeli violation of the Vienna Convention, I think it is time for Iran to say, this is how powerful I am, this is how I can become, and it is up to you to stop violating international law and threatening a nation like Iran. And I think that was an excellent statement by the IRGC commander.
All right, and finally, quickly, you know, this is the first major threat, not that Israel has not made these types of threats before, but it comes after Operation True Promise, so that the game is different now. The landscape is different after this operation. But now that it's issued that threat, Iran has come out and made its rebuttal on this, its response. Do you think that there is going to be a decision made by the Israeli regime to still follow through with the attack that it has said that it's going to do? Because we're looking at different, I guess, equations here. One is the fact that we've seen what Iran's missiles and drones can do. The second, we are seeing the Iran's posture to have changed, saying the era of hit and run is over by the Israeli regime. We are going to attack Israel from our soil if it was to pursue anything that would obviously be in the form of an attack on the Islamic Republic. What do you think?
I think what Iran is doing is protecting its advisors in Syria and protecting its domestic security. Because the Israelis are thinking, and they've leaked this information, of hitting the Iranians in Syria, saying, well, we're not going to hit your territory, but we're going to hit your advisors. Or perhaps use the CIA and Mossad to hit in the northwest in the Kurdish area, or in Sistan, Baluchistan, or carry out assassination that the Mossad has done before. Now, I think the strategic patience has been exhausted, and it is time for Iran to show that it's a shark with teeth that can be used only if attacked. And Iran is not going to take the initiative, because for the last, since the Iranian Revolution has started in 1979, it has been attacked by Saddam Hussein Iraq, and its nuclear scientists have been killed, so many riots that continue. And I think this announcement today is going to stop and defend the Iranian domestic security, because it is sending a very clear message to the Americans and to the Israelis that if you continue pushing us, this is where we're going. And I think that is that move. Many people around the world were waiting to see what is can be done for the Americans to feel that they are only allowed to go and launch missiles against another country. They are the only one who start a war. They are the only one who have this kind of capability that Iran showed on the 14th of April. When Iran showed a face where the Palestinians have never dreamt of seeing missiles hitting Palestine, but hitting the Israelis in Palestine. That was the real feast and real Eid that the Palestinians have observed, because at the last, they've seen someone who's telling the Israeli, stop your arrogance, you do not control anything, and your power emanates from the Americans.
All right, thank you very much. We can continue to talk about this. We just don't have the time. It was a pleasure talking to you, as usual. Elijah Magny there, talking to us from Brussels. We appreciate it. Thank you. Well, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed Iran's recent punitive operation against Israel as a legitimate and deserved response to the regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The movement said that Iran's operation ended the era of Israel's impunity and unaccountability. Hamas also deplored Western countries' concerted action to defend Israel against Iran's punitive operation. It said Western states that defend Israel have remained totally silent on the regime's genocide in Gaza and the repression of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The movement also reiterated its call on Arab and Muslim nations, as well as regional resistance groups, to continue supporting Palestinians in their struggle to liberate their occupied territories. The ongoing Israeli aggression has caused more deaths and destruction in the besieged Gaza Strip, 195 days into the regime's genocidal war. Palestinian medical sources say that at least 3 civilians were killed and dozens of others wounded in Israeli artillery shelling in central Gaza. To the south in Rafah, nearly a dozen Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli bombings of a residential building. Fatalities include 5 children and 2 women from one family. Also in the north of the Gaza Strip, rescue workers have recovered the bodies of 30 people from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital. The death toll from the Israeli genocide has now risen to nearly 34,000. Thousands of people are feared to be trapped under the rubble of their homes. Most of the victims of the U.S.-backed onslaught are women and children. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that a man-made famine is tightening its grip on Gaza, as Israel continues to block aid into the besieged strip and seeks to end UNRWA's activities.
Children are bearing the brunt of this war. More than 17,000 are separated from their families, left to face the horror of Gaza alone. Children are killed, injured, and starved, deprived of any physical or psychological safety. Across Gaza, a man-made famine is tightening its grip. In the north, infant and young children have begun to die of malnutrition and dehydration. Across the border, food and clean water wait. But UNRWA is denied permission to deliver this aid and save lives. This outrage is occurring despite consecutive order by the International Court of Justice to increase the flow of aid into Gaza, which can be done if there is sufficient political will. You have the power to make the difference. UNRWA's mandate is supported by an overwhelmingly majority of member states. Yet the agency is under enormous strain. It is facing a campaign to push it out of the occupied Palestinian territory. The agency's requests to deliver aid to the north are repeatedly denied. Our staff are barred from coordination meetings between Israel and humanitarian actors. Worse, UNRWA premises and staff have been targeted since the beginning of the war. 178 UNRWA personnel have been killed.
Lazzarini also said that its members who had been detained were tortured in Israeli custody, with some of them being stripped naked, among other forms of abuse. The agency says several detainees were also subjected to insults and humiliation, such as the deprivation of water, food, sleep, and toilets. In some cases, they were made to act like animals and were urinated on. UNRWA said in other cases, the detainees were threatened with prolonged detention, injury, or the killing of their family members. Israel has a history of mistreatment of detainees, as some UN rapporteurs in the past had documented Israeli abuse of Palestinians held in jails. The resistance movement Hamas has called the torture of Palestinians affirmation of the regime's brutality and war crimes in Gaza. Sabir Abu Maryam, Secretary General of Palestine Foundation, Pakistan, joined us earlier with his take on a report from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees on Israeli crimes, including the torture of aid workers in Gaza.
First of all, I would like to say that what Zionist regime Israel has done to the Palestinians in Gaza so far and is now targeting aid workers, especially the workers of UNRWA, is a clear proof of Israel's defeat, and Israel is committed all kinds of inhuman acts and crime against the humanity. So this is the time that the international community must boycott Zionist regime. It is very surprised that the UNRWA chief was presenting the report in the UN floor, and the Israeli representative, who is the killer of innocent Palestinian people, who is the killer of aid workers of UNRWA and other UN agencies, she was sitting next to him. It is very surprising, and the question mark of the United Nations reputation. So these inhuman acts, these inhuman actions of Zionist regime must be condemned at every level, at all level. And this is the responsibility of international community to stand up against these kinds of killers. And yes, Israel has set the worst example of brutality in the Gaza Strip, and also killing the Palestinian people as well as aid agency workers, especially the workers of UNRWA and other international agencies. Those are trying to support oppressed people of Palestine and providing the first aid.
The UN Security Council is set to vote on the Palestinians' bid to become a full member of the United Nations. According to diplomatic sources, the vote is expected on Thursday or Friday. Malta, which holds the rotating presidency of the 15-member council, has yet to confirm the schedule. Currently, Palestine has a permanent observer status to the world body. They sent a letter earlier this month requesting for a permanent membership at the UN. The request, which amounts to the recognition of Palestine as a state, must first pass through the Security Council before being endorsed by the General Assembly. The resolution needs at least 9 votes in favor and no vetoes by the US, Britain, France, Russia, or China. Informed sources say that the resolution has the support of 13 members, but the US, a key backer of the Israeli regime, is likely to veto the move. Geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson says Palestinians know that the US will veto their bid to become a full UN member, but they want the whole world to see Washington's policy.
The United States is not going to allow this to happen. They're firmly in the grip of the Zionist lobby. But it's always good to force a dictatorship to act like one. Unlike in previous times, where even when there's UN resolutions condemning settlements and things like that, the U.S. always uses its veto power to knock these things down, and the press doesn't cover it. But with the opening up of X under Elon Musk, a lot of people for the first time, especially after watching this in real time, the horror of the famine and the slaughter in Gaza that Israel has been implementing on these people collectively, they're going to see America come to the rescue for Israel again. Why can't Palestine have statehood? Why can't they be a permanent member of the UN? Why not? Because the Americans are blocking it. And that is a question a lot of Americans are going to wonder. How is this in U.S. interest? Don't we want peace? Aren't they already a state? How come they are not afforded the same rights as others? Why are we so beholden to Israel? This is what this is forcing the U.S. to do. They know that this will fail. They know the U.S. will veto it. And they want the world to see that.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain is facing food shortages and price rises because of various extreme weather events. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The United Kingdom faces food shortages and price rises as extreme weather linked to climate breakdown causes low yields on farms locally and abroad. Record rainfall has meant farmers in many parts of the United Kingdom have been unable to plant crops such as potatoes, wheat, and vegetables during the key spring season. Crops that have been planted are of poor quality, with some rotting in the ground. The persistent wet weather has also meant a high mortality rate for lambs on Britain's hills, while some dairy cows have been unable to be turned out onto grass, meaning they will produce less milk. Agricultural groups have said the United Kingdom will be more reliant on imports, but similarly, wet conditions in European countries such as France and Germany, as well as drought in Morocco, have meant there is less food to import. Economists have warned this could cause food inflation to rise, meaning higher prices at supermarkets in Britain. Tom Bradshaw, the president of the National Farmers Union, said markets had collapsed as farmers failed to produce food in the punishing conditions. He added, "We're going to be importing a lot more product this year." One major retailer said the wholesale price of potatoes was up 60% year on year as much of the crop had rotted in the ground. Supplies of potatoes have also been affected by a 10% reduction in the area planted last year as farmers switched to less weather-dependent and more financially secure crops. Industry insiders said they expected a further 5% fall in planting this year. Jack Ward, chief executive of the British Growers Association, said there is a concern that we won't ever have the volumes of potatoes we had in the past in the future. He said wholesale prices were too low for farmers to generate enough income to cope with high price of fuel, labour and machinery costs, as well as the effects of climate breakdown. We're not in a good position and it is 100% not sustainable. Supplies of carrots and parsnips, which are left in the ground and are also affected by southern soils, are also much lower than usual, pushing up prices. Martin Lines, the chief executive of Nature Friendly Farming Network, said, "The impact in the United Kingdom this year will significantly affect potatoes and the salad crop. Farmers are already facing delays in planting, with many fields in poor conditions. If planting occurs at all, it will likely be late, potentially leading to a shortage of root vegetables and potatoes this coming winter. Some farmers have ceased planning for planting altogether, opting instead to put fields into fallow or switch to alternative crops. This could also result in shortage of wheat, barley and pulses, as it's currently unprofitable to grow these due to the lateness of the season and low forecasted prices." Jai Singh Watson, the founder of the organic vegetables box company, Riverford, said he had so far planted virtually no vegetables. Some overgrown plants cannot wait any longer to go in the ground and will have to be ditched. While retailers often turn to imports to fill gaps on the shelves, farmers across Europe are enduring a similarly difficult start to the year, with difficulties developing winter crops and sowing spring crops. France is experiencing the poorest start of its wheat growing season since 2020 amid cold and wet weather, while production of fruit and vegetables in Morocco is being affected by drought. Morocco's second largest reservoir has dried up, meaning irrigating crops will be difficult. Amber Sawyer, an analyst at Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, said last year almost a third of the UK's tomatoes and more than two-thirds of its raspberries and Brussels sprouts came from Morocco. And climate change worsens, the threat to our food supply chains, both at home and abroad, will grow, according to Amber Sawyer. Scientists have said this is just the beginning of the shocks to the food supply chain caused by climate breakdown, and that without rapid action to drive down emissions by ceasing to burn fossil fuels, the current system is unsustainable. Dr. Paul Behrens, an Associate Professor of Environmental Change at Leiden University in the Netherlands, said, "We should all be extremely concerned. We need to be doing everything to reduce carbon emissions while transforming our food systems." He added, "If we don't, I expect huge turmoil and escalating prices in the next 10 to 20 years. When food prices spiral, we always expect political instability. I wish people understood the urgent climate threat to our near-term food security. Fortunately, we know many ways we can make the food system more resilient while reducing food emissions. The biggest opportunity in high-income nations is a reduction in meat consumption and exploration of more plants in our diets." The British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story and tells us more. Food shortages are alarmingly likely in 2024 as climate change, transportation issues and global conflicts continue to affect supplies, according to a food security expert. New checks will also be introduced on goods coming into the United Kingdom from the European Union at the end of January under a border target operating model, further impacting food imports into Britain. Professor Chris Elliott of Queen's University in Belfast in Northern Ireland said the fruit and vegetables will be particularly affected. It follows shortages of eggs and oil throughout 2023, with supermarkets forced to ration tomatoes and cucumbers due to poor weather in southern Europe in February. Professor Chris Elliott, who chaired the government inquiry into the 2013 horse meat scandal, said, "My expectation is, as we've already seen in 2023 with some empty supermarket shelves for months, this will become more persistent as we go forward." It was about affordability but also availability and the likelihood of empty shelves, particularly fresh produce shelves in 2024, is very high. The food security expert said the potential shortages were caused by food insecurity in other countries, climate change and transportation issues. He also criticised the government for a lack of long-term planning and said the United Kingdom's agricultural industry has collapsed. Professor Chris Elliott pointed to Singapore, which has introduced plans to grow up to 30% of its own food by 2030, having relied almost exclusively on imports, as a good example for Britain to follow. He said, "We're virtually totally dependent on other countries for most of our fresh produce, our fruit and our vegetables. We are reasonably self-sufficient in dairy products, We were reasonably self-sufficient in poultry and in eggs. But that's also on the decline now as a result of the collapse of the food industry or sectors of the food industry in the United Kingdom. A 2021 food security report found that 46% of food consumed in Britain in 2020 was imported.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
There seems to be a similarity or link between the Wahhabis and people like Mutawakkil in the past. And the common bond between them is this hatred towards the Ahlul Bayt, bughz of Ahlul Bayt, or as we call them, you know, Nasibi. And this is where we see that, you know, Mutawakkil was the most cruel and tyrant ruler of Banu Abbas. Now remember, Banu Abbas are actually a branch of Bani Hashim. Bani Hashim is divided into two branches. One is Ali Rasul, and the other is Banu Abbas from Abdullah, the descendants of Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet. And so they are actually cousins of the Ahlul Bayt in a way. And they also came to power when they fought against Banu Umayyah in the name of the Ahlul Bayt. They used that name of somebody from Ali Muhammad. We are fighting for them. But when the time came to grab the power, they took it. There was one segment of Ali Rasul who had supported them, and they were the descendants of Imam Hassan. And so Banu Abbas considered Ali Hassan to be their biggest threat because they were the one who supported them. And they used their name that we are fighting for Ali Rasul. And therefore the first campaign of Banu Abbas was to eliminate Ali Hassan. And if you look at history, you will see that those were the days when descendants of Imam Hassan had to run away from the mainland Muslim empire, all the way from Morocco on one side and Sindh and Pakistan on the other side. Even if you look at the family of the king of Morocco, they are all Hassani Sadat. And initially they were all Shia. Later on, because of Taqiyya, they lost their, you know, path and they have become Sunnis. And so when we look at Banu Abbas, although they were cousins, but there was always this tension. And the worst among them was Mutawakkil. He could not tolerate the Shias going for the ziyarat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. And so what we see Najdi people doing in 1802 is nothing new. You know, for them, the precedence is of Mutawakkil, the Abbasid Khalifa, where he, in the year 236 of the Hijra, the Islamic calendar, you know, first he tried to erase any indication of the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. There were instructions that nobody will go for ziyarat, but he was not very successful. Again, in year 237, he tried that again. And even a decade after that, he did the third attempt. But he was never able to stop the Shias. Even if they had to suffer, they would still go for the ziyarat. And they would go and erase everything, but they would go and still put a mark there, a temporary shade or something on the grave, that people would know that this is the place you go for ziyarat of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And so when we look at this issue, you know, the question is, why you want to attack the shrines? If you believe that the Shias are on the wrong, you know, have a discussion. Nobody asks you to have arguments, publications, or whatever. Why target the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt? Because they know that just as the Kaaba is very important for Muslims, they believe 100%, 110% that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't reside there. Their aqeedah is very pure. Yet they have this, you know, strong attachment to that building. I'm sure any of you are going for Hajj, especially for the first time, when you go into the Masjid al-Haram and you really see the Kaaba with your eyes, it is a feeling that you cannot describe. It is completely different. And this is where we come to realize that although it's just, you know, bricks, stones, nothing else, it is not a house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He doesn't need a house. You know, yet this nisbat, you know, when Allah says something is related to me, that entity becomes very important. And that is where, you know, that nisbat becomes more powerful. There is a very interesting conversation of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And I think it was Abu Dharr who was the narrator. And this is when the Prophet is there after Fatah Makkah, or the last Hajj by the Kaaba. And Rasulullah addresses the Kaaba and he says, O Kaaba, I know that your hurmat, your sanctity, your sacredness, your holiness is very great in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But O Kaaba, you should know that the hurmat and sanctity of a mu'min is greater than yours. Rasulullah is saying, yes, this is very important, very sacred. But when it comes to the hurmat of a mu'min, and if you have a mu'min who is Sayyid al-Shuhada, you know, what would be his hurmat? And this is where we see that when they attack, you know, it's actually worse than attacking the Kaaba. It seems that, you know, for them, anything which symbolizes Hussein ibn Ali, anything just symbolizes the Ahlul Bayt, you know, they want to destroy that. Any memory, any connection that the people would have with the Ahlul Bayt through these visitations. And that's why these, you know, places become the target of those who have this bughz and hatred towards the Ahlul Bayt. You know, when Mutawakkil, he came later on in the 3rd century of the Islamic era, and Karbala took place early days. When he was doing all this, trying to erase the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, one of the poets of Baghdad those days, by the name of Ali bin Muhammad al-Baghdadi, actually uttered, you know, three lines of poetry, which became very, you know, famous at that time. And it reflected, you know, in his views, the motivation of Mutawakkil. And he says, Tallahi in kanat Umayya qad atat qatla ibn bint nabiyha mazluman. He says, by Allah, it is true that Banu Umayya, you know, committed this crime of killing the son of the daughter of their own prophet. They did this mazluman, unjustly. وَلَقَدْ أَتَاهُ بَنُوا أَبِيهِ بِمِثْلِهِ. He says, but when I look what Mutawakkil is doing, he says his cousins, the Abbasid, did the same thing. هَذَا لِعُمْرِي قَبْرُهُ مَحْدُومًا. By my life I see the grave of Hussein has been demolished. And then he talks about this motivation of Muawiyah, of Mutawakkil, why he's doing this. أَسَفُوا أَنْ لَا يَكُونُوا شَارَكُوا فِي قَتْلِهِ فَتَّبِعُوهُ رَمِيمًا. It seems as if, you know, they regret that why they were not there in Karbala to kill Hussein. And out of that regret now, they are targeting the grave of Hussein. And so this demolition of the shrines of Ahlul Bayt for us is a reflection of that, you know, boast, which started with Banu Umayyah, continued with people like Mutawakkil, and it came all the way. You know, we saw even Saddam during our time trying to stop the process of Arba'een of Sayyid al-Shuhada. But Mutawakkil is gone. Nobody remembers him. The shrine of Hussein is there. Saddam is gone, but the Arba'een of Hussein is there. And we hope that one day, whether Saudis are there or not, the shrines of Ahlul Bayt in Baqi will be rebuilt, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Azim عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in the last few days, Israeli media has been reporting about Indonesia mulling normalization of relations with the Tel Aviv regime to fulfill the requirements for accession to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. and neoliberal market-based alliance countries. The news circulated at a dizzying pace on social media platforms and triggered a wide array of reactions from netizens worldwide, including in Indonesia. It wasn't something they were expecting. Indonesian Foreign Ministry was quick to deny the reports in a midnight statement, saying no such plan was in offing. The ministry spokesperson, Lalo Muhammad Iqbal, said, "I affirm that, as of now, there are no plans to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, particularly given Israel's actions in Gaza. Most people in Indonesia reject and condemn any plan that leads to the normalization of ties between the two sides or Jakarta's recognition of the apartheid colonial entity." Several notes can be taken from this frenzy. First, the behavior of the Israeli media, citing anonymous sources to report on Indonesia's plans to normalize relations with Israel. It has happened several times in the last few years. Indonesian Foreign Ministry has always denied such reports. It again denied it, and then it was as if there was nothing more. There was no apology from the Israeli media, nor was there any criticism of the Israeli media from the Indonesian side. Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In 1934, when the Palestinians fought against the British, at that time Indonesia was still colonized by the Dutch, the clergy in Indonesia collected donations from the people to help Palestine. It is also recorded in history that a rich Palestinian businessman, Muhammad Ali Taher, in 1944 donated a large amount of money to the struggle for Indonesian independence. In history lessons at schools, our teachers often repeated the phrase, "Palestine was the first to recognize Indonesia's independence." What it actually meant is that after the proclamation of Indonesian independence on August 17, 1945, the Indonesian diplomat M. Zain Hassan came to Egypt to promote recognition of that independence. In order to support Hassan's efforts, a number of resistance figures in the Arab world based in Cairo founded Lajnatud Dafa'in Indonesia on October 16, 1945, including General Saleh Har Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, and Abdurrahman Azam Pasha, Chairman of the Palestine Committee. The recommendation from the Lajna was a resolution to support the Republic of Indonesia and an appeal to all countries, especially Arab and Islamic countries, to recognize the new republic. After that, almost all the Arab countries recognized the Republic of Indonesia one by one. Apart from that, Indonesia initiated and hosted the Asia-Africa Conference from April 18th to 24th, 1955, the first conference of formerly colonized countries in the world whose main spirit was to liberate all the colonized people on Earth. Support for Palestinian independence was one of the dominant issues at this conference. Indonesia has a historical burden to maintain that spirit and fulfill its promise of independence for Palestine. The third point is, it needs to be acknowledged that there are indeed parties in Indonesia, both politicians and prominent figures, who are secretly establishing personal relations with Israel. Indonesia's decision to submit a membership application to the OECD, an organization controlled by Western capitalist countries, instead of joining a new economic power that is far more promising for shared prosperity, namely BRICS, shows the dominance of the West in Indonesia's economic posture. Membership in the OECD requires the consent of all members, including Israel. It is very possible that there are figures behind the scenes who are trying to normalize Indonesia-Israel for their interests, especially business interests. However, they never expressed their intentions openly because it would be tantamount to political suicide. No politician in Indonesia would dare to commit suicide at this time when public sentiment is very strong in supporting Palestine and against Israel's genocidal crimes in Gaza. Thus, it can be concluded that the rumors of normalization were Israeli propaganda that took advantage of the tendencies of a few parties behind the scenes, but which immediately hit a wall of failure. The Indonesian people will not allow that normalization to happen, as Indonesia's first president, Sukarno, stated, "As long as the independence of the Palestinian people has not been handed over to the Palestinian people, the Indonesian people will always stand up to challenge Israeli colonialism."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. We have announced that by a certain deadline, we should have 20,000 megawatts of nuclear power. This is the country's need. The country seriously needs 20,000 megawatts of nuclear power. This figure has been calculated by organizations in charge. Of course, besides this, there are many other needs and benefits that we should pursue. But they do not want these achievements to be made. Of course, they want to preserve pressures and at the same time, they want to destroy the nuclear industry. They do not intend to lift all sanctions as you can see in the present time. They even threaten to impose more sanctions. This is one point.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second point is that our opposing side, the current administration of America, and decision makers in that country need these negotiations. This is the other side of the matter. They need this. It is considered a great victory for them if they can achieve their goal in the negotiations. This is, in fact, a victory over the Islamic Revolution. It is a victory over a people who have claims of independence. It is a victory over a country that can be a model for other countries. The American managerial apparatus needs these negotiations. All the arguments, bargaining, lies, and tricks that their excellencies use focus on these two issues. From the beginning, we entered the arena in a reasonable way. We spoke in a reasonable way, and we did not show greed. We said that the other side has imposed cruel sanctions, and therefore they should be lifted. Very well. This is a give-and-take relationship. It is all right with us to give something. We are ready to give something so that sanctions are lifted. However, the nuclear industry should not stop and come to any harm. This is the first thing that we said. We have said this from the beginning, and we have followed it until today. These are the most important red lines that have existed. We mentioned certain things as the main guidelines.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.